So I do hope that you'll come back tonight for a special activity. We're going to try something new. We're going to mix adults, teenagers, and children together in groups and have some mixed groups. It's described on the front of your link, where we will further explore the meaning of this psalm, Psalm 23. We've designed the hour to be very kid-friendly, but also to challenge the adults who are there to apply this psalm and think about how this psalm applies to our lives. I sometimes hear that there aren't enough times for different ages in the church to interact with each other. Well, here's that opportunity. This is a perfect opportunity to do that, to do it in a meaningful way. So I hope you'll come. You can meet in the fellowship hall at 6 p.m. sharp and be 5 minutes early. I know that's against most of you guys' religion, but go ahead and try to do it anyway. If you'll be there 5 minutes early, we'll be able to divide everybody up into groups in a good way. It's going to be nice for me. I'm really looking forward to it. Camp reminds me how I miss spending time with kids, studying and talking about the Bible. Kids are excellent discussion partners. They really are, if you give them the opportunity. But you have to engage them in ways that work for them. You know, they don't understand some of our ways of discussing. Some people think that you've got to go high tech to talk to younger people. And I don't think that's true. At least I hope that's not true, because I am not an early adopter of technology. Just a few months ago, I broke down and bought a Kindle. Okay, so some of you guys have e-readers and Kindles and things like that, or you're reading them on your phone, or at least I think that's what you're doing in here when I see you with your phones out. But the Kindle is the electronic reader that comes from Amazon, and it is really pretty cool what it can do. I can take a whole stack of books with me on vacation, and instead of carrying a box like this, I can just carry that little Kindle with me and still sleep and do whatever I want to, right? But one of the functions that I like the best on the Kindle is the ability to just tap and highlight these large sections of text. And then you go onto your Amazon account, onto the Kindle part of your Amazon account, and there all the highlights that you've made in that whole book are right there on that sheet for you. It's really pretty nifty. And I've used that a lot in studying and things, because it just puts it all right there together. But I found out not too long ago, you know, that not only are they keeping records, good old Amazon, of what I highlight, they're keeping records of what all of us are highlighting. And matter of fact, you can go on Kindle there and you can see what other people are highlighting in their books. Or in books that are popular, you can see what passages people are highlighting. Matter of fact, Amazon can tell you the rates, you know, at which people are highlighting different sections or different sentences or pieces of text. Big Brother is definitely still looking over your shoulder here. The number one most highlighted passage in all Kindle books, Amazon says, is not from the 23rd Psalm, by the way. The number one highlighted passage, it's highlighted more than twice as often as any other passages. You guys have a guess? It's from the second book in the Hunger Games trilogy. So the Hunger Games, it's kind of written, a lot of teenagers have read the Hunger Games. A lot of you adults have probably read the Hunger Games. The blurb on this is that the Hunger Games is about a dystopian future where adolescents are trained by adults for desperate but meaningless life or death competitions. So I assume that's about high school or what, something like that? It sounds like high school? Okay. One of the reasons for the statistical popularity is obviously that there are a lot of people reading the Hunger Games, and a lot of people are reading the Hunger Games on their Kindles, on e-readers. But I've read the sentence that's the most highlighted passage, and I look at it and I think, you know, there's really nothing fantastic about that sentence. There's nothing lyrical about it. It's not one of the great phrases in the English language that 10 years from now people are going to be quoting to each other. But there must be something about the passage, because, I mean, people could be highlighting something else, right, if they wanted to. So they're choosing this. And here's the passage. Here's the most highlighted passage. It's this. Because sometimes things happen to people and they're not equipped to deal with them. Do you remember reading that in the book? Because sometimes things happen to people and they're not equipped to deal with them. So that's resonating with somebody out there. You know, one of the things about being young is that you don't have a past body of experience to be able to predict how things are probably going to go in the future. You're kind of winging it new on all these things. And I say probably going to go because if you think things are always going to go in the future the way they've gone for you in the past, or the way you envision they should go, well, that's detachment from reality, isn't it? So when young people feel uncertain about their own status, or perhaps their identity, or when they see instability in the job market or in the world, then it's natural to feel anxiety. It's natural to feel fear about the future. They don't know how to predict that. How's that going to go? I don't have those past experiences. And one task that we're driven to by our nature is to prepare ourselves to deal with the future. But if the future becomes uncertain, then how do you prepare for it? I think that's one of the reasons why the 23rd Psalm is probably thought of as one of the most comforting passages in the Bible. When people are facing difficulty, they often turn to that passage. We all sometimes feel, if we're honest, like wandering sheep. Like things are kind of, like we're kind of unanchored. Like we don't know where things are going. How to predict the future. How to predict tomorrow. And we want to think that someone is guiding our steps. That's comforting. To think that someone is with us in our wandering. Somebody who's going to make things all turn out right in the end. But that's not to say Psalm 23 is an easy psalm to accept, is it? It's much more challenging than the idyllic, rather bland images that this conjures up in our mind, or tends to conjure up in our mind. I can't get past the first verse without struggling with it. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall lack nothing, or I shall not want. Really? So if your shepherd is the Lord, then you're not going to lack anything? In what sense is that true? What does it mean to the new mother who hears the doctor say, your child is never going to lead a normal life? Does she lack anything? What does it mean to people who struggle with mental illness? Or the people that love those people who struggle with mental illness? They will not lack. What does it mean to the 14 million people living in refugee camps in the world today? Half of them are Christians. Most of them will never go home. Most of them will never be resettled in a home. They'll live in that camp the rest of their life. What does it mean that if the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want? I think it's true, but in what sense is it true? I don't think it means what some of the TV preachers say it means, or for that matter, what those of us living pretty comfortable lives subconsciously want it to mean. Get in touch with this part of yourself and be honest, right? What's going on in your head? I've got this life somehow because I deserve it. I've got this life. I'm in this position because somehow somebody, my parents did something right, or my grandparents made a good choice, and so I've got this life. Somehow I deserve it. Bad things happen to people because somehow they deserve it. Now, I'm not going to blame them. I don't think they should be heaped with guilt. But somehow they messed up. They did something wrong. We'd never say it out loud. We think it because when things are going well, even when things just seem okay, it's comforting to think that you're going to dodge that bullet. You're going to dodge that bullet that you see on the nightly news. That you're like Teflon, nothing's going to stick to you, like the stuff you read about in the paper. Somehow I can control my life. I'm in this control of my life, and I can prevent those things happening to me. We want to manage our lives so that we can ensure our own happiness, our own safety, and the happiness and safety of the people that we love. Of course we do. But the reality is, much of life is pretty unpredictable. And we're sorry because we don't tell you that often enough. That we sometimes hear predictability in this psalm is more probably a projection of our own needs on this psalm than what the psalm itself actually says. Psalm 23 is more complex than that. Think about it, where do people raise sheep? Comfortable surroundings usually, from air-conditioned Barca loungers. People don't usually raise sheep in lush, comfortable locations. They raise sheep in the wilderness. They raise sheep in dry, inhospitable terrain, in the mountains, in the deserts, in the badlands. You place the sheep, the flock there, and the shepherd there, and then suddenly all this lying down in green pastures and finding still waters, maybe that's less a picture of beautiful, cuddly, fluffy sheep romping and relaxing by the stream, and more an image of exhausted, smelly, dirty, scared animals finding a place to be able to lie down for a moment where there's just enough food and just enough water and it's just in time. And this shepherd, no, he's not operating from the easy chair. He needs a rod. That's his club. That's his shillelagh there. I mean, that's for protection. That's to fight off predators. And he needs a staff, and that's there to prod the sheep, pull them around, push them where he wants them to go. The sheep feels the sharp poke in the ribs when he thinks about the staff. It's not velvet covered. The whole image of a shepherd was much more complex in ancient times. Kings in the ancient world were called shepherds of their people. And kings weren't always the nice guys. The hieroglyph for Pharaoh was a shepherd's staff. That staff had a pastoral sense, that's true, of a responsibility to give care, sustenance. But it also was a symbol of authority, make no doubt about it. This showed who was in control, who was reigning, who was in charge. It was the symbol of a leader. And those paths of righteousness, or the right paths, as your translation may say it, those aren't necessarily easy paths, are they? Do you notice that they go through the valley of the shadow of death? And that image, the valley of the shadow of death, or dark valleys, that's not an image that's just limited to death. There are lots of dark valleys in life. There are lots of valleys that are filled with the destructive power of evil in the world. You take it all together, all of these images, if you can kind of shift a little bit, when you hear it, it's as much a picture of the precariousness of life as it is a picture of tranquility. Life, as it is, often difficult, sometimes on the edge of danger, hanging by a thread. Life, like it is for most of the animal kingdom. And like it is, let's be honest, for most people in this world, it's not easy. And then in the middle of the psalm, the image changes from shepherd and sheep to host at a table and a guest at the banquet. The host prepares a table for me, but it's, notice, in the presence of my enemies. And the gracious host provides for this guest now with abundance. Not just the food and the drink and the shelter that the shepherd gave the sheep, but now there's this abundant overflowing of goodness and mercy. And God is doing this all for His name's sake. I always read that like God is kind of glorifying His name, pointing out, look at me, here's what I deserve. But no, the graciousness and mercy, the grace and the mercy and the love, it's in God's name because it's in keeping with God's name. It's right there parallel with God's name. It is the revealing of God's character. God to Moses on the mountain when He gave the Ten Commandments described God's own self this way. The Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for the thousandth generation. Mercy and grace, those are God's own self-definition, God's own character. And the psalmist says that goodness and mercy are sure to follow Him, sure to follow. That word follow there in Hebrew would better be translated, and think about how this would change the psalm for you. It's better translated pursue. Goodness and mercy are pursuing me. Usually in the Psalms, it's your enemies that are pursuing you, right? And here is a picture of God in pursuit of a human being with goodness and mercy, even in the presence of enemies. You know, again, here's this psalm that doesn't try to explain why bad things happen sometimes to innocent people, but affirms that we can be confident that God is working for us, that working the good for us. It's a beautiful image. It's a wonderful image. And it's wonderful because sometimes things happen to people and they're not equipped to deal with them. Both images that this psalm presents, the shepherd and the sheep and the host and the guest, are familiar, aren't they? Jesus uses both of those images as well for God, and uses those images about Himself. And both of those images imply a relationship that goes back and forth. They're not a mechanical, it's not a mechanical relationship. It's a biological relationship. Two living beings relating to each other. Sheep can obey or they can disobey. They can go the wrong direction. Guests can be polite or they can burp at your table. We're not robots. And God is not a child playing with toys. God intimately cares for us. God wills our good constantly. And the outcome is a relationship and real life that's more complex than our simple, selfish desire for a one-to-one correspondence between the bad or the good things that happen to us and whether we deserve them or not. The challenge for us as people of faith, and I think that it's implied in this psalm and it's reinforced time and again in Scripture, and it comes to fullest fruition in the New Testament, is that we're not to let our day-to-day circumstances, our uncertainties of the moment, the instability in our life, our doubts our fears, the unrest in the world around us, the clogged toilets in our bathrooms, not to let our suffering or the evil that seems to dog this world in our steps, not to let those things be what determines our actions. But instead, we are to be reflections of God's own character in this world, to radiate that same goodness and mercy, to pursue others with goodness and mercy, no matter our circumstances. That's faithfulness. Faithfulness. And when we walk through valleys of deep darkness, down in those deepest canyons where the light disappears the fastest, that's where we're going to be most tempted to doubt God's presence or to doubt God's goodness. But notice this psalm. The path that goes through the valley of the shadow of death is as much a path of righteousness as the one that goes by the still waters and the one that goes by the green pastures. Those are right paths too. This past week, there was a conference here at the building, the Refugee Roundtable Conference, and people came from really all over North America for this to talk about their work with people who find themselves as refugees. And it was really an encouraging thing. I ended up staying for a lot more of it than I planned on, just because it's so encouraging to be around these people. And these are people of faith. And they worshiped as well when they got together. And I noticed a lot of North Lakers took up my invitation and came by at different times during the week. And I hope you were as inspired by them as I was. One night, one of the speakers, a man who works very closely with the United Nations High Commission on Refugees, as a bridge between them and faith communities. And he travels a lot throughout the world and visits a lot of the camps, a lot of the refugee camps. And he spoke, and he had just a powerful, I thought, message. And he told a story that just caught me. And it was about a refugee camp in the country of Malawi. Now, Malawi in Africa is one of the very poorest countries in the world. He had a photo of a child, a little interaction he had with a child in that camp. And in the picture, you see these barren huts behind her. You don't see a blade of grass on the ground or a tree anywhere in the distance. It is a barren country. And yet they are housing tens and tens of thousands of people in that country who are refugees from other countries where there are wars and they've had to run away with their families. But he told about that camp. And he told about, well, the thing that I was most interested in were him telling about the churches in that camp. Many of the people in the camp are Christians. And there are many churches in the camp. And one of the things he said that so struck him when he was in that camp was that each of the little churches, and most of them were about 200 people, each of the little churches had gotten together and said, here's what we're going to do. We're going to take our ration that we get each month of food from the United Nations, and we're going to tithe that ration. And we're going to pool it together as a church. And he said, a tenth of all of those 200 people's rations of food in that 200 people in, say, any individual one of those churches was worth about $70. $70. And he said they took that tenth and they had committed to use that tithe, their tithe, of their meager ration of food to feed the people, especially the widows and the orphans, in the villages and the towns outside of the camp in that country of Malawi. And they were sending that money or that food out of that camp to feed those people in the surrounding villages. That's powerful. That's faithfulness. That's not letting your circumstances, which must be incredibly, and he told some stories about this too, and you don't have to imagine very much, the despair that would envelop your life. The crushing nature of that. And yet, but their faithfulness to Christ impelled them to act in this way. It reminds me of another story. Another poor man saw a lot of other poor people, and he had compassion on them as a shepherd has compassion on his sheep, because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And all he had was a few loaves of bread and a couple of fish. And he told those people to sit down on the green grass. And he took the bread and he looked up to heaven and he thanked God and he broke the bread and he gave it to the people. And they all ate and they were satisfied. When we feel overwhelmed, when we feel unequipped to deal with the things in life that are happening to us, it's time to look to heaven. It's time to give thanks and to give just what we have. No more, just what you have. God knows it's all you have. And then you can work on trusting God. The Good Shepherd who gathers us around this table. And trust that God will make it enough. Then it's up to God. When we give all we have, then it's up to God to make it enough. But we are called to be faithful in spite of our circumstances. We're going to read one more time Psalm 23 together. And let's read it slowly. Take our time. Think it through. Let's read. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me in right paths for His name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil, for You are with me. Your rod and Your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. If there's any way that this church can minister to you today, if you'd like to come and find out more about this congregation, find out more about Scripture, what we believe, if you'd like to learn more about Jesus, if you'd like to come and ask for the prayers of this congregation, I invite you to come now as we stand and sing.